had a lot of interesting weeks in the history of this podcast. I believe we started in my freshman year of college, if I recall, Brad. So we've been going at this thing for a while. But last week was probably one of the more interesting, challenging, et cetera, weeks that I've been a part of in college hoops. We're not going to be Debbie Downer about everything because we got a lot to get to. I know you guys love to tune into the pod for news and notes and all the stuff about the season and just kind of go big picture on all the leagues and what we do every week. And we will get to that. But I just wanted to first just kind of come on and say thank you. I know a lot of people reached out after the Sports Illustrated news on Friday. I would say first, I don't know that much more than what's on social media. I think I understand the dynamics of the relationship that Sports Illustrated has with its ownership a little bit better, but it's very complicated. In short, I have not lost my job, which is good. I'm glad to still be covering college basketball for Sports Illustrated, at least in the near term of a day of a period that has been told to us is 90 days. What happens after all of that, I don't know. Obviously, any updates that I have that would impact this podcast, we will let you guys know as we go. But certainly, I don't foresee any reason why that would stop, at least in the short term. So appreciate you listening, as always. Appreciate all the support. Brad has been great. But I will say those the days like Friday are days that the old non-basketball job business sounds a little less a little less terrible, because that was certainly no fun.
Yeah, I think I'm still willing to do the podcast with you if you get canned.
You're still willing. Okay.
Yeah. You know, you wouldn't have that fancy title next to your name.
Well, I appreciate that, Brad. I will say, one of the many texts I received from a couple of friends in the media space was that if my job changed in some form and I was no longer allowed to do podcasts, if whatever is next for me forbade me from doing the CWB Central pod, that the basketball world would be losing a legend in Brad, and that you would have to find a way to get your takes back, you know, out into the ether as best you could, because we can't lose your voice.
My newest take fixation is people's reactions to the net.
We're off.
It's been what, at least 4 years of net. And people just either don't get it or don't want to get it. I mean, maybe it's me. Maybe I'm a weird guy. I have all these depth charts. I keep track of everything. But like, if I'm into something, I want to like learn how it works. And other people just don't want to do that, it seems. And they just want to complain. And it just boggles my mind.
The net is not that complicated. I think there's a strong case that the net is not the best system. I think there's a strong case that other systems that it mostly imitates do what the net does better.
Yeah, exactly.
There are individual results from the net that do not make a lot of sense. For instance, it was flagged to me this morning, I believe, that Utah State won by 25. Presumably covering whatever spread would have been expected against Fresno State, and somehow dropped four spots, which we assume was because of San Francisco and UC Irvine losing. Just like some bizarre stuff like that. But people really lose their minds when talking about the net, and it is quite humorous to me.
I mean, as long as you stick with the following principles: win by a lot, probably moving up. Lose by a lot, you're probably moving down. And you get more points for a road game than a home than a neutral site game than a home game. And that the net number you see is a ranking and not a calculated number. If you understand those three things, you're in business. Where the NCAA, because I saw David Warlock had a snippy tweet at Providence beat writer Kevin McNamara about the net. And where people like, and I'm going to group him in with the NCAA.
David Warlock.
Yes.
That seems reasonable, as he does work for the NCAA.
Where they screwed up is on the initial net, when they went with the technicality that scoring margin is capped at 10 points. That's where all this net nonsense unraveled. Because while that was technically true, and efficiency is not technically scoring margin, for all intents and purposes, it is scoring margin. Oh, it's scoring margin divided by possession. Okay, who cares? People see these like 20-point results and it's like, but I thought you said scoring margin is capped. Like, it is not capped at all. And they were the ones who pushed that out originally. I think since they've removed that portion of the net. Well,
yeah, it was funny because the net originally had these like five pillars. And one of them was the scoring margin capped at 10, which was stupid to begin with. And he's even more stupid when you consider that the main pillar was efficiency margin. And then they realized that the net was too noisy. So they got rid of three of the pillars, but like didn't really publicize it that much. So you just still have people who, as you said, just like, I thought the scoring margin was capped at 10, and they're idiots because the scoring margin.
You can't argue with these people because they give you a link to the original article where scoring margin is capped at 10, and you say, but efficiency, and they say, but scoring margin is capped at 10. It's literally the whole COVID mask thing, where they said, oh, you don't need masks, and then it's like, yeah, you do. And they're like, well, you already said we didn't. Like, you already said we're capping score margin. It's like, well, no, clearly it's not, and it shouldn't be. Score margin shouldn't be capped.
Well, certainly if the net's supposed to be what the net is, then it should not be capped. If the net had no interest in efficiency and was just if the net was just like the RPI, then scoring margin could be capped. I saw I think it was Carrie Miller tweeted that it's one thing for people to have net takes, but we haven't had anyone have the courage yet to say that the RPI was a good system. And I do think it's funny to look back at the RPI, because I don't think it was nearly as bad as people thought.
Well, it was like crazily designed, where they like, they valued total unweighted wins. So it was like a cheat code to schedule, you know, Vermont and New Mexico State and all those teams. Where now, if you can schedule them and beat the shit out of them, then it's a cheat code.
So what I find funny, let's read the RPI. We've got plenty to get to. We're not going to go down this rabbit hole too much. Let me read you the top 20 of the RPI right now. Although these results seem like completely, never mind. Hold on, I gotta find a better RPI. That's not the right RPI. Here we go. All right, the RPI. Number one, Purdue. Number two, Tennessee. Number three, Dayton. Number four, San Diego State. Number five, Utah State. Number six, North Carolina. Number seven, Houston. Number eight, Colorado State. Number nine, Wisconsin. Number 10, Kansas. How about number 11, Syracuse? 12, UConn. 13, New Mexico. 14, Arizona. 15, Auburn. 16, Clemson. 17, Ole Miss. 18, Memphis. 19, Alabama. 20, Marquette. I guess the Syracuse thing makes sense, of that Syracuse getting blown out by the good teams doesn't hurt them, and struggling with the bad teams doesn't hurt them either. They win all the games they're supposed to win. They lose all the games they're supposed to lose. But it's not a great system, certainly. But it's not – I don't know how much worse it is than the net. It's – let me put it this way. It may be a better measure of resume than the net is.
Well, yeah, the net is just useless. Like, it's not bad per se, but it's like, why – what am I going to look at the net for except – That's the official one that they've chosen. Like, I'm just going to check T-Rank or Ken Palm or Eric Haslam or one of those, right? Like, what is the instance where I need to pull up the net to see the strength of a team?
Well, I think the other thing that's a problem is that we have this net as a sorting tool thing.
Yeah, like, people don't understand the cutoffs.
Well, they also don't understand that, like, the NCAA just says, the net does not, your own net does not matter. And then people's minds are blown. And then, because it's not true. Like, it's the biggest fraud that exists.
Go on the bubble with a net of 110 and see how that works out for you.
I would be curious to know, like, I think we've discussed in the past, like, what is the cutoff?
I think the Chris Mullins St. John's team ended up at like 77.
I think if you're in the 70s, it takes like something really, really drastic.
But like we say this every year about the charlatans on the selection committee that just want to hang out with their buddies and have a nice lunch comped by the NCAA and take 3 days in what could take 45 minutes. It's musical metrics.
Yes.
Everything matters until it doesn't. Wins versus quadrant one versus quadrant four losses versus KPI versus wins above bubble. When you have 30 things you can choose from, you can justify anything.
I will say, and then we can wrap up our conversation about bracketing and move on to the actual games. One of the more funny discussions we've had of all time is the fact that the committee feels that they need to start meeting on like Wednesday of selection week. To just like start doing the work. I think you could group like, I'm trying to think of like, you could put like your parents, my parents, your wife's parents, my girlfriend's parents, and then like four random people off the street, and you could tell them they've never watched college basketball before. And here's how, let me explain to you how this works for an hour, and then hand them the team sheets, and they could pick like 31 out of the 36 at large teams within like 5 hours probably.
And that's probably also the point, because these athletic directors that they've chosen, they're not exactly Jordan Sperber.
That's true.
But I, my dad would not participate in that whatsoever. I offered him my Friars tickets for a game, which he pays for. And he acted like I was handing him plutonium.
So. All right. Enough on the bracket. We should start with probably the biggest news for the like overall season of college basketball, and that is the Terrence Shannon update. Terrence Shannon is back with Illinois. There is no guarantee that this continues forever, but presumably at least, this will give him the ability to play out the rest of the season for Illinois. He received a temporary a TRO, which has become one of the words of the season in college basketball, a temporary restraining order to allow him to play because he was not given due process by Illinois in suspending him while he is under investigation for or while he is facing charges for rape in Kansas. Terrence Shannon sued and believed that he was losing potential earnings via NIL and impacting his future earnings in the NBA. I think the case itself is very interesting. I won't bore anyone with the details, but the bottom line is that Terrence Shannon is back with Illinois. He played Sunday. Today we're recording. He was second on the team in scoring with 16 points, came off the bench, played pretty well. Certainly a big deal. Brad, I guess, how much does this change your outlook on Illinois? I think they probably were better than we would have anticipated without him. But with him, I think we both agreed that the ceiling was very high. That being said, this situation is, so strange. It doesn't feel like it has gotten the negative backlash that the Brandon Miller situation did, just because I think Illinois has handled it with a far better, a far greater deal of grace. And also, I think there's an understanding of, like, Illinois is not actively volunteering to play him. This was a legal matter. This feels relatively unprecedented, and it's adding one of the best players in the sport back into the mix just from a basketball standpoint here with, 6 or 8 weeks left in the regular season.
Yeah, because we've just been conditioned that, if a player is accused of, sexual assault, certainly, but I think other crimes, too, that they were just going to have to sit out until it was resolved. And that's just kind of what we understood, fair or not. But you can see from the school's perspective, if they, put their fingers in their ears and say, we're going to play this guy through the allegation, and then it turns out that it's true, or they get more evidence, or he's found guilty, then it looks really cynical that they just wanted to win basketball games. And that's the same thing with this fan reaction. You know, people saying, "Oh, you know, why are they giving him a standing ovation?" I agree. A standing ovation is excessive. You know, probably the correct or the more appropriate response is, "I'm glad he's back." Maybe be try to be more even keeled, despite being
excited. I will say
Final Four is on table, but go on. Sorry.
I will say this with Terrence. This I do not perceive the Illinois fan reaction as, "Woo! Thank God that Terrence is allowed to play, so we can make the Final Four." Maybe that's what's underpinning all of this. But I don't think I've seen a legal situation like this where like a fan base is so assured of a player's innocence. And again, I mean, we don't need to do the legalese here. I will say that when you look at the case, it is not a slam dunk case, if nothing else. There's a lot of he said, she said in this. Obviously, you know, what happened or what is alleged to have happened is very, very serious. We certainly hope that it didn't happen, as was stated. We see no reason not to believe the victim, but at the same time, I think there is a different level to this where it's not like, oh, he was caught with a smoking gun in hand, right? I think Illinois fans truly believe Terrence Shannon is being like ramrodded by the system and deserves to be free and is like getting screwed. How true that is, I don't know, but that is how I have perceived the reaction. It is not standing ovation, thank God the rapist is back to play basketball. It is, thank God that the kid that we love is playing for us again. If that makes sense.
Kind of similar to like the why is a standing ovation was like the Jim Boeheim car accident one. And even you mentioned the Brandon Miller one from last year. Where it's like, not saying he's deserves to be in jail or is guilty, but like the standing ovation is kind of weird.
Agreed. And I mean, look, Illinois goes on the road for the first time on Wednesday. They come to my alma mater, Northwestern. It is not going to be a pretty sight. It like Terrence is going to hear it on the road. Honestly, it is going to be vile what is said to whether he is guilty or not. What is said in student sections and stuff is going to be vile. My hope is that everything stays like clean in terms of there's no incidents. There's no, you know, I am worried about what happens when Terrence Shannon goes into Illinois or Northwestern on Wednesday. I'm worried about what happens when Terrence Shannon goes into Michigan State in a couple of weeks or Maryland in a week after that, like, or Wisconsin in the first weekend in March. Like, I am worried about what happens there because I think it's going to be a powder keg. It is going to be really, really, really delicate. And it's just an awkward situation. There's not really an easy way out of it. It's where we are. But just from a pure basketball standpoint, I mean, it's season changing for Illinois, right? I mean, it's hard to not think that adding the guy who averaged 20, we can say all we want how good they looked without him. It's hard to say, oh, the guy who is like the best athlete in the country and, you know, averages 21 and, you know, 21 points a game and shoots 38% from three and 63 from two isn't going to make a huge difference at all.
Yeah, he's like a top five player in the country. Yeah. I mean, this obviously changes their ceiling. Helps the Big Ten because you figure without him, Illinois looked good. They looked okay. But, I mean, you know, I would certainly take, 15, 20 teams over them at least. And now they have a top five player in the country back, so they're probably back in the top 10 for as long as Terrence Shannon is still in the mix. I guess staying in the Big Ten.
Yeah, go for it.
I had chastised everyone last week who did not believe that Michigan State's record was going to turn around. And they got their two wins this week, but it was ugly. They looked even with Minnesota. I watched most of that game on Thursday. And then Maryland, I was not able to watch this game, but from all accounts, was equally a slog.
Yeah, look, I watched a good amount of Maryland. I didn't watch much of Minnesota. So I guess we're opposites. They just don't seem to have enough talent to separate in these games. And again, I don't know how much of that is 3-point shooting. I mean, Michigan State was 3-for-12 from three today. You know, they were 3-for-12 against Minnesota the game before that, even against Rutgers when they had like their little surge. They were, you know, that was the game when they blew out. They were 12-for-25, but like it took them a while to get there. That was a big run down the stretch of the game. I mean, that game was 37-36 with 12, 13 minutes ago, and then it just kind of got away from Rutgers. So, yeah, I think we both were in agreement. Michigan State's a tournament team. I think we still agree. We still buy that. These two games, especially with Roadrunner Maryland, I think kind of solidify that, like, yeah, they're going to be okay, right? They're not gonna miss the tournament. But I don't think they've done anything really outside of the Baylor game where you look up and you say, yeah, like, that's a team that's going to really make a move in the Big Ten.
And then their next. Well, so they have at Wisconsin next, which they are dogs in.
Yeah.
Then their next, what, eight games are going to be favored by at least 3 points, according to T-Rank. The toughest in that mix being home Illinois. But they get that whole kind of middle bottom of the conference. They're still projected on T-Rank to go 12-8.
Yeah, KenPom is 12-8 as well, 20-11. Which
that'll be good enough. The James Madison loss is technically a bad loss, but there's been such a reverence given to James Madison this year that's not going to matter. The rest of the losses are to very good teams, and they have the Baylor win. The Butler win is solid. Indiana State's top 25 in T-Rank, for what it's worth. Baylor's sneakily down to 24, but that's going to be good enough at 12-8.
Yeah, they're going to be fine at 12-8 for sure. I will say this, though. I mean, if they're 12-8, that means they're 20-11 overall, which means they're going to lose a game in the conference tournament and have 12 losses, and they're going to lose a game in the NCAA tournament, and they're going to have 13 losses. That means Michigan State, 4 years in a row, will lose 13 ball games. Like, it starts to feel a little Syracuse-y.
I can see that, yeah. Because it's also kind of that early entry that got Syracuse. You know, they're losing Tyler Ennis and Jeremy Grant and all these guys year after year. You know, Chris McCullough, Malachi Richardson, you know, they're losing like a starter a year. Michigan State, what, they had Max Christie. No one last year, I don't think, but they've lost their fair share of early entry guys, and they're not portaling to replace while everyone else is portaling,
right,
which we've talked about to death, but it's true. Next year they will have to portal at least one guy.
One who's technically an early entry is Joey Hauser.
That's right.
Because Joey had another year. So
a lot of those random – and now Hauser, I think – and the up getting a two-way this year eventually, but a lot of these random guys not choosing to use the COVID year, you're kind of like shaking your head, especially with all the money out there supposedly changing hands. But
I don't think there's too much that's new in the Big Ten this week. I think there was a few missed opportunities. Maryland, we mentioned the Michigan State game, they also lost a 3-point, you know, rock fight against Northwestern. Blew a little bit of the momentum that they built from beating Illinois last weekend. You know, if they had split these two games, I think you start to say, okay, look, you know, maybe they can start building towards the tournament. I just think it's going to be hard without really running up a number. That offense is just not consistent enough. It's just too hard for them to manufacture points. You know, that hurt them. Iowa had an opportunity to really flip their fortunes, never really pushed Purdue in the second half. I thought they played okay. You know, Freeman had foul trouble, which I think hurt them. They're a good team. I still believe in Iowa as probably one of the, you know, better mid-pack teams in the league, but you know, still looking for that breakthrough. You mentioned Minnesota, three losses in a row now, leading into you know, not an easy stretch with Wisconsin coming up on Tuesday, then road Penn State, Northwestern, Michigan State, Iowa, and Purdue. So as this year's Big Ten goes, kind of a trickier stretch. I think some of that early optimism was, you know, just more of a statement on the schedule. Beat Nebraska at home, good win, you know, not great. Beat Michigan on the road, not great. Maryland at home, you know, these are games you win when you're, you know, even an NIT team, let alone, I don't think they've proven enough. I think that Rutgers is playing better, but, you know, I had that nice win over Nebraska, but haven't done enough. Northwestern Nebraska was a bubbly game on Saturday. Nebraska won that one behind another, you know, late game flourish from Tominaga. I think Nebraska is like, Nebraska and Northwestern are very similar. I feel okay about both right now. I think it'll be, it's hard right now because there's so many like theoreticals in the bracketology world. I think as it gets more real, we'll have a better sense of like how many of those type teams get in. But I still think that the core four in the conference, Wisconsin, Purdue, Illinois, Michigan State will carry it. And then some group of Northwestern, Nebraska, Iowa, Ohio State. Maybe there's one more that can play their way into the mix. But I think.
Speaking of the Buckeyes, though, so their next four games are going to define their season. At Nebraska, at Northwestern, home Illinois, and at Iowa. T-Rank has the line in that game, in those four games, between 0.2 and 1.6 for all four of those games.
Yeah, a little bit more spread in the on 10-pound up to three in the Illinois game, but
so that's four coin flip games that are going to decide their season. To this point, they have one top 100 win. Two top 100 wins. The neutral against Bama, which is a monster win, and then home Minnesota, who's at 97. Still very much a blank slate, even, you know, some of their worst losses to Penn State and to Indiana. Those, you know, their metrics aren't good, certainly, but they're not in killer land. So for the most part, it's a relatively blank slate with one great win. And these next 2 weeks, they can build off it. As for how they look kind of aesthetically, I've been kind of underwhelmed with their talent level. Dating back to the charity Dayton game, they played West Virginia to end the non-con in like a crazily close game to a roster that was completely in flux. It's the high-end talent level, I think. I like Thornton and Gale, but I think they're still maybe a year away from being the best players on a good Big Ten team.
I guess the way I would put it is this, like, Ohio State's been fine, but they've had three road games that they've lost, and all those games were really right there for the taking. They just couldn't quite find a way. In Penn State, they led by, I think, 17 or 18 in the second half, blew it late. Indiana was like a tie game. They were up most of the way. It was, you know, it was 52 to 50 with 10 minutes to play. You don't find a way to win it. And then the Michigan game, they led in the second half. We're up 59 to 55 with 7 minutes to play. You know, win the game. Like, those are all winnable road games. None of those teams are top half Big Ten teams. To be a tournament team, you have to win those type of road games. Either that or you have to be a force at home. They haven't been so far. They lost to Wisconsin. They lost to A&M at home in the non-conference. So, as you said, they got work to do. They're one of those swing teams. I just think at the end of the day, it'll sort itself out in this league. I think the levels have kind of spoken for themselves so far. But I think the league that I'm most interested in from a bid standpoint is the SEC, other than the Mountain West, which, Brad, as you know, I mean, all anyone can talk about is the Mountain West.
How mad are you at Steve Alford and the Wolfpack?
Yeah, I mean, I think Nevada's actually fine. I think
you gotta stay in line, though.
Huh?
You gotta stay in line. You know, the six bid Mountain West. You got to clean up against those bottom five. Let's break your brain.
Yeah, sorry. Nevada. Nevada at least has a real resume. I mean, they beat TCU. They beat Washington on the road. They beat Georgia Tech on the neutral. They beat – who was the other team that they beat? That was, like, somewhat notable. think that might be it from like a real resume standpoint.
Maybe one in conference.
They always play a lot of like RPI games. Like they played
goalie lock schedules. Yeah.
Yeah, UC Davis and Weber State and you know stuff like that. So they got to do it in conference. They've lost three in a row and the schedule doesn't get easier. I mean, they go home Colorado State, at New Mexico, home San Jose, at Utah State, home San Diego State, home New Mexico, at UNLV. You know, and that's I think just going to be big picture the largest challenge for the Mountain West. I don't have like big takeaways from this past week other than that like UNLV is think it's really asserting itself as being really good and that's going to cause some problems for people. I also think at the end of the day, like I think when I look at the Mountain West, it's just going to be hard. It's going to be hard for the team that goes 10-8. It's just the reality of it.
Yeah, and from a top 25 perspective, I mean, unless you're, because I've been kind of shocked that Gary Parrish has just been like cycling his teams out. Like he has, you know, San Diego State in one day, they lose a road game, and he just puts the team that they lost to in, and then they lose a road game, and he just keeps like firing them through. It's like he either put like two of them in and just keep them in and kind of ride out the ebbs and flows, or just put none of the Mountain West teams in your top 25 and fill it with Big 12 teams. The problem, if you can't handle them losing a road game, then just keep them out.
Yeah, the problem with the top 25s right now, this is the present problem, is that everyone realized they had to rank Utah State. Then Utah State beat Colorado State and one other team. And then other teams lost who were among the good ones. Like New Mexico beat San Diego State, Colorado State lost to Boise. And so all of a sudden, Utah State had to be the highest ranked of the group. So they were like 16th. But like I don't think anyone actually believed that Utah State was the best of the group. But then all Utah State did this week was lose to New Mexico at the Pit. So you couldn't take Utah State out of the rankings. Like, they're going to drop 9 spots for losing at home to or on the road at one of the toughest environments to like a tournament team? I mean, that doesn't work. So now they're like kind of stuck ranking Utah State like 20th still, even if they don't really believe that. And like they have to keep Colorado State below them and they have to keep New Mexico below them because New Mexico lost to Colorado State, but New Mexico already beat Utah State. It's just a mess. But anyway.
And Boise looks good. Omar Stanley, one of the many St. John's transfers that are falling out.
Boise's got a good resume. They don't really pass the eye test as much, but
no, like
got to keep avoiding the losses.
I mean, I would not be scared at all of playing a Tyson Dagenhart, Omar Stanley front line. Like it's small. It's in terms of athleticism, that's not going to compare to any, you know, 6 or 7 seed that they're going to play in the first round if they make it. And their guards are not as good as they've been in recent years.
Yeah, Roddy Anderson was not a great addition. They needed.
He's not Marcus Shaver. Or. Derek Marks or many of the great guards of Boise State's past, but they get a lot of mileage out of these like long athletic wings that, you know, Agbo now, but they've had obviously Chandler Hutchinson, Anthony Drimmick, Derek Alston, like feels like every year.
Abu Kijab.
Yeah. And now, you know, Leon Rice had rebooted Boise State a couple of times where, you know, they had the Drimmick and Marks team. Then a few years later, they had the Chandler Hutchinson team make it. And now it's like an every year thing where it's probably the strength of the Mountain West is kind of where the rising tide lifts all boats. But
I will say it is absolutely wild. Like Boise State's probably like an average job in that league. They're like essentially a perennial tournament team right now. And I see people on Twitter like kind of regularly questioning Leon Rice, being like, I saw people tweeting like, oh, you know, like, because this Kayshon Pryor kid for South Florida has been really good.
Yeah.
But people tweeting like, oh, like more proof Leon Rice can't develop his bench. And I'm like, guys, like, I don't know, like he makes the tournament every year. Like, like what are we expecting here? Like Leon Rice to me is one of the best coaches in the country.
Who are the teams that do develop their bench? Like if I had, if I just told you, name the first coach that pops into your head that turns bench players into starters over time, who are you going with?
My initial thought would be Roy Williams doing the just force feed minutes to the bigs.
Yeah.
Which I think is happening right now for Baylor with Josh Ojanwuna. Because every time I watch him, he does something stupid, but then he just keeps playing because I think they're like, ah, well.
They're losing Yves Missi this year to the NBA.
Yes.
Who, on the Finkelstein podcast, they said he's already 19. So he was originally in the class of 2024. He would have been like a 20-year-old freshman. Whatever works. But yeah, the first name that was popping into my head is still Mike Bray from when he did that, you know, in like the old Big East, and probably the last guy he did that with was Matt Farrell, who went from like 13th man as a freshman to eventual starting point guard as a I think as soon as it's like end of his sophomore year. But anyway.
Yeah, but that was nuts. Okay, let me get back to my original talking point, which is I think the SEC has become the most interesting NCAA tournament conference, and maybe just the most interesting conference race in general, right? So top line, I think there's four legitimate, or excuse me, I think there's three very real, like, title contenders in the SEC. Not just regular season title, like NCAA title. I think Auburn, I think Tennessee, and I think Kentucky. Right. We could talk about the Big Z debut. That was wild, you know, insane. All the adjectives. It was what it was. But I think all three of those teams have proven themselves as some form of elite. Auburn has 16 wins by double figures. They're top 10 in offense and defense. They're super balanced. They're getting good guard play. They're defending at an elite level. They have the interior size. They have the coach. They have it all. Tennessee has Dalton Knecht surging back to life, playing really, really well. Had that like lull midseason where he's coming off the ankle injury. Now he's had 25, 39, 36, and 28 in his last four games. Probably will be like National Player of the Week this week. Was just ridiculous against Florida earlier in the week and then had a good game against Alabama. They blew out Alabama, sucked the life out of them. Their offense is top 20. Their defense is number two in the country. They're really darn good. Then Kentucky, as I mentioned, Big Z. How big of an impact he winds up making, I think it's still very much open to question. But I think you and I would have probably agreed that this was the title level team without him, right? They have the speed. They have the shot creation, the depth, the ability for different guys to step up on different nights. Like, Kentucky will have its bumps, and Kentucky really has never been able to break through in the metrics. I think it's very funny that preseason Kentucky was 18 in KenPom, and today they're 16, as though like nothing has happened, when I think they've been way better than everyone expected. Like, just aesthetically, you fully buy that team is a true contender. So you got three teams at the top. You've got two teams at the bottom and a potential third, but two teams that are like clearly not good, Vanderbilt and Mizzou. And I think Arkansas may wind up in that category too.
Maybe Ole Miss too.
Ole Miss, hold on. Let me get there.
Sorry.
Those teams have no hope. Arkansas has zero chance. They're 1-4 in the league. They're, you know, all the way out of the top 100 in KenPom. They still have a lot of schedule left. I mean, they've lost now they lost at home to South Carolina over the weekend. I'm going to call it over for Arkansas. I'll be happily wrong if I'm wrong. Everyone in between that, I guess maybe LSU is probably out. Everyone in between that has like a very real path to the NCAA tournament. South Carolina and Georgia both are like hovering around in the 50s or 60s in the metrics. They can both, you know, they've both really improved. I think they're both probably NIT teams, but like neither really has done anything to screw it up yet. You've got Mississippi State, you got Florida, A&M. I don't think any of those teams are overwhelming by any means. Ole Miss, certainly not overwhelming, but all those teams have accomplished something, right? eventually someone's going to fall off, right? The Big Ten teaches us this year after year. It gets really hard to get below like eight, above like eight or nine bids, because Team 10 is still losing a lot of games. But I think if you were asking me like which league is getting the most bids right now, I think I'd probably say the SEC.
Well, I'd say the Big 12 for that. SEC for me. Right. So we have four teams that everyone thinks is going to make it, right? Auburn, Tennessee, Bama, Kentucky. It's kind of crazy. On a T rank, Kentucky's 99th in defense.
Yeah, they're like 75th in KenPom.
Which I haven't heard a lot of defensive complaints among either Kentucky fans or observers. The only complaint that I hear is that they're starting Wagner and Edwards over Dillingham and Shepard. That's literally the only complaints I've heard for weeks. Which, I mean, they're winning a ton, so it's not a huge deal. I think the defense is more concerning. But when Tiaro gets back, now they have another 7-footer they can throw in there. We'll see where that defense heads. But they have those four. And then I'm still confident in that Mississippi State and Florida will make it. They can get six. I don't really like South Carolina has survived so far on like a real Goldilocks schedule, and now they have Kentucky on Tuesday. That's a clear your schedule to watch that game. I feel Kentucky's gonna blow them out, but if they didn't even hang with Kentucky, then it's kind of like, all right, maybe this team is for real. And then I'm unclear whether to give up or not on Texas A&M.
I wouldn't give up.
I want to see a little more from them. They have, you know, that two seasons ago pulled off a crazy late season run as well. And as for Georgia, I mean, when they were playing Providence, I was still, you know, kind of whining over the fact we lost to Kansas State. And everyone's telling me, like, dude, we just watched this game. Georgia's not bad. That's going to be a good win for us. And I'm like, no, you guys are crazy. They're going to be 120 in KenPom or net or whatever. But they're hanging in there. Jabri Abdur-Rahim is shooting the lights out. I'm not sure if he's still shooting the lights out. He was last time I checked.
He is shooting 43% from three. Still shooting the lights out.
Pretty darn good. And their guards have been very good. Noah Thomason's been good. The freshmen have been good.
Yes, Silas Demery has had a good game against Kentucky. 22 points. Double figures in five of his last six.
And then a Russell Chiwa has been a little better than anticipated as well. So, yeah, so some of these teams are good teams. Like LSU, I think, has turned a corner a little bit, but I don't think that they're going to make the tournament, right? I wouldn't even call, like, Arkansas and Missouri, like, bad teams, but it's just not good enough for this league, which I pegged as the best league in the preseason. I think all the numbers are pointing toward the Big 12, but I just love the top of this league. I mean, Auburn, Tennessee, and Kentucky, I mean, I definitely put those teams ahead of the top three in the Big 12.
I agree with that 100%. I will say this. My preseason Final Four pick that I tweeted of Purdue, Arizona, Tennessee, and Auburn, I feel like it looks pretty good.
Only thing holding you back is historic failures of Rick Barnes and Purdue.
And the bracket. Inevitably, they'll probably get like one will be a two seed in the other region.
Well, I guess, I mean, speaking of one seeds, it seems like the consensus is that North Carolina is a one seed right now. As the ACC continues to falter more by the day, if they are – so they're currently two games up on first place in the ACC. I mean, if they can run through this, they're going to probably be favored in every game except for at Duke, right?
Yeah.
I mean, they go 17-1. They are a one seed, but it still doesn't feel super firm. Like
I think my take with Carolina is that they peaked in the Syracuse game. I don't actually think they played that well. against Louisville or against Boston College. And, like, their next – let me put this way. Their next seven games, which is home Wake, at Florida State, at Georgia Tech, home Duke, home Clemson, at Miami, at Syracuse, I think I'd be surprised if they didn't lose twice.
But, like, you listing those off, none of those games scare you.
No, I agree. I just think they're going to come back to earth, and the teams are going to start shooting the ball better against them. I still think they're really good. I just think that they're – like, I wouldn't be surprised if Wake beats them on Monday.
That would be huge for both the ACC and for Wake. As Wake is, like, literally sitting on everyone's cut line right now. And, you know, we kind of back-to-back weeks. And two weeks ago, I was talking about how Virginia Tech was, you know, doomed as a program. And then, like, looking at their T rank, like, the next day, I was like, you know what? They're actually not in bad shape. And I think that getting that road win against NC State, they're in even better shape than when I made that realization. And then same with Clemson last week, where I still think Clemson in terms of quality is a bubble team, but their resume is pretty strong, that they're safely into this point, and they're going to have to, you know, have a swoon similar to last year to actually get on the wrong side.
I got absolutely shredded by the bracketology charlatans for my assertion that Memphis was closer to the bubble than people realize. Because they were like, well, look at their KPI. Their KPI is like 12th. People love the... I understand these things have to be a part of the process. But I don't think anyone even knows that these resume metrics exist, except for the committee members. Except for the bracketologists. I bet the committee members don't even really know what they are. Because they basically just represent the quadrants.
But I saw somebody tell you today that, like, your KPI was wrong because that's, like, the last one to update.
Yeah.
And I was like, I've never even – I don't even know where to find KPI, let alone know that out of all 15 resume metrics that I checked today, that's the last one to update. Like, that's another level of probably unnecessary dedication. Yeah, the whole Memphis thing is just because they played a dream schedule where I think they only played three bye games, which, like, everyone should aspire to have that many compelling matchups on your schedule. And now I guess you can see if you do that, maybe you'll give up some home games. But your resume in terms of metrics are going to look crazy. And, you know, back to the people complaining section, but if people are going to complain about how the quadrants are divided or how the selection process is, right, like if you're anti-quadrant and you throw a fit every time a team moves into a different quadrant, like, oh, Pitt's now 69, like, what a stupid system. The only way out is to just do a wins above bubble formula.
You're big on the wins above bubble.
Well, right, like, if you're having, like, an existential crisis because teams and games can move from one quadrant to another, there's no division that you can do that will not have that in terms of grouping teams.
So let me ask you this. The wins above bubble people all want there to be no committee, no, like, literally just, like, you generate the wins above bubble and, like, those are the teams that
get it. That's it, yeah.
Do you support that? Because I have no issue with the concept of the wins above bubble. I have an issue with the idea that there is just one computer system that, like, you just wait to refresh after every game to decide whether you made the tournament or not.
So I do not like the actual wins above bubble metric because I think it was purposefully designed to prop up the Vermonts and the McNeeses of the world. I think it was literally made to give them it was engineered to give them a shot against the Providence, Wake Forest,
the
high major.
Right. Well, yes, I think, yeah, the concept of wins above bubble is essentially rooted in the idea that going 18-2 in a mid-major league based on percentages is still really, really hard.
Yeah, because if you have a 90% chance to win, whatever, I mean, I should actually do the math here, right? But if you have a 90% chance to win, two games, that's 81% to win both, right? Then 73.
Well, here's an easy way of doing this. Let's say it's February 1st. You got 10 games left. You're a 90% chance to win each game. Overall, you would be expected, based on percentages, to win 9 games. If you went 10-0, you would be 1 win above bubble. The problem is that, like, rewarding teams for winning, you know, like, I think the formula is waiting is wrong, as you said.
Yeah.
It slightly overvalues the 90% game.
And I think they're using KenPom for the weights, which...
Correct.
Which
They use a different system similar to KenPom, I believe.
Right, because the whole thing is, wins above bubble doesn't use scoring margin or any sort of margin of victory. But if it's using, like, a KenPom sort of thing for the weights, then it is. But,
either way.
Yeah, so I don't like that specific metric, but I think having one metric decide who makes the playoffs and who doesn't is fine. I'm okay with that. As someone who, as a Providence fan, Providence is always on the outside of the formula and always on the inside of the committee nonsense. But, like, as a rational person, I think I'm fine with just one metric deciding. Because, like, the KenPoms of the world do make a good point where, like, the quadrant system and how we have learned to use it, you're just counting some games and not others. Right? Like, I was having a semi-argument with someone was like, well, why didn't we play this bye game on the road? Then it would be a quadrant three. And I was like, well, who cares about a quadrant three game? They're like, you're telling me that quadrant three isn't worth more than quadrant four? It's like, well, yes, but no. Like, yes, it's worth more, but still nobody cares. And I think the fact that we're just picking certain... You know, like, with a Memphis, we're like, yeah, okay, cool, Arkansas and Michigan, all that stuff for quadrant two games, but we don't really care about that. You know, like, this idea that we only care about these certain top games, I agree that can be...
My issue is that we'd put all the bracketologists out of work.
Yeah,
What would these guys do?
They could just project. See, all the bracketologists do a projection until we get to a certain point. I'm not sure what that point is. Right? But, like, on November 5th, they're not putting out, a one seed is San Francisco because they just got a road win at Bradley. There's a point where it flips from projection to this is what it is right now. And my whole thing, the hill I'll die on, is it's got to be projection literally up until Selection Sunday. Until after the Big Ten championship. Well, and that's the other thing with the formula, is that it is ridiculous that they don't even count the last 3 days of games. That's
crazy.
That's unfathomable. Imagine explaining that to someone. Like, yeah, the last 3 days of games, which are super intense, super highly anticipated, all over national TV, they don't actually count because the selection committee doesn't want to redo anything that they've already done.
Because
the process
takes
3 days instead of 45 minutes.
It's so crazy. I mean, I was talking to a coach in the Ivy League about this. Like, It's terrible for the league. Like, them playing Sunday really hurts their seeding.
Well, this can be a 12 this year, right?
I mean,
maybe a 13, but
I actually think Princeton has a chance in that large.
Their only losses to whom?
St. Joe's.
That's not looking as great as it did, and the Rutgers win is not aging as well as it
their,
did.
Their problem is that all of their wins have aged poorly. They were really happy, like so they beat Rutgers on a neutral. That doesn't mean that much anymore. They beat Duquesne on the road. That was like a huge win. Duquesne's now last in the A-10. They beat Furman at home. Furman's having its worst year in a while. They beat Drexel at home. That's a good win.
Yeah, Drexel's undefeated
in their league. But you know, they won at Delaware. They beat Hofstra on the road. They're really good. Like, they would be winning the CAA if nothing else.
Talk about a Goldilocks schedule. Holy crap.
So, well, here's the other crazy thing. I mean, they basically have not played for like a month and a half. They played all those games by like December 10th. Since December 10th, they've played 6 games, of which 2 of them were non-division 1.
That's another thing that we have to get rid of. You can't play non-division 1 teams. That's just so absurd. It's smart to do because it doesn't count toward the net. But like, there's 365 teams. You can't find another team to play?
The thing I will defend Princeton on is that Princeton only gets 14 league games because the Ivy League is so small. So even if they don't play an MTE, that still means you got to go find 15 non-conference, like 14 non-conference games.
Yeah. Maybe you should give them the Hawaii treatment. Let them play in multiple MTEs.
I think Princeton has a real at-large chance. I think Grand Canyon has a real at-large chance.
I mean, same boat as Indiana State, though, where that they're not going to have beaten any good teams.
Right. The question will be: will they take all of those teams? Will they take none of them? Or like, what? Like, how are we going to separate Indiana State from Princeton?
I mean, at the end of the day, they're probably going to win their conference tournament.
Probably, yeah.
Was that last year the first year that we had no bid thieves? Is that right?
It was the first time in a while, yeah.
Yeah. So I guess, you know, Drake and Bradley are pretty strong right now.
Yes.
The WAC is not strong outside of Grand Canyon.
It's not strong per se, but like, Seattle's 120, Stephen F. Austin's 128. Like, you know, there's some teams in there that don't stink.
Speaking of the Ivy League, I was looking through the screenshots in my phone today to find a recipe, and I found a screenshot that I had tweeted around this time last year where a Georgetown fan posted on their message board that he wanted to move to the Ivy League. Do you think that the Ivy League would have accepted Georgetown?
No, they're very exclusive.
Yeah.
The academics aren't good enough.
If Georgetown tried to leave the Big East for the Ivy League and they got turned down, San Diego State did?
They'd have to go to the Patriot League and hang out with, like, Bucknell. Yeah. What was the recipe? This is the important info.
It was I did not make it yet, but there was this, like, back of the Bisquick box a chicken tender batter, and I just needed the amount of time it goes in the oven so then I can use my own batter on chicken tenders to make boneless tenders.
There you go.
I didn't know how long to cook it and what temperature, which is why I could never make a recipe. Three things: I don't know how long to cook things, I don't know what temperature the oven should be without them telling me, or the proportion of spices.
Oh, man. I mean, I'm in the same boat, Brad. I'm in the same boat.
What's a teaspoon of paprika versus half a teaspoon of paprika? I don't know the effects on the overall recipe, but anyway, go on.
anyway, where were we? I guess we could talk just like bigger. I feel like we've glossed over some like bigger results, like Memphis losing twice. I think both of us were pretty skeptical about Memphis here lately. I would not have been surprised to hear that they lost to Tulane. I would have been surprised to hear them lose to South Florida. Their resume is fine, as we said, because of these, you know, quad two and quad three games. But T-Rank does say, like, their projections, as you say, you know, the bracket obviously has to project. T-Rank's projections have Memphis falling into the last four in. And you know, that relies on, like, losing to North Texas and losing to SMU and getting tripped up by, you know, East Carolina. Like those things.
They're 78th. Who is? They're 78th in T-Rank.
Memphis is?
Yeah.
See, that's wild, because they're 51st in KenPom.
It's because I think T-Rank, similar to Eric Haslam, has a sort of analytically final cutoff.
Uh-huh.
But, like, looking at their recent games, like, obviously the two losses we just described, and they blew out Wichita, but overtime against San Antonio, 3 points against SMU, who's 21 in T-Rank, that's kind of crazy. 3 points versus Tulsa, 2 points versus Vanderbilt, that's a real killer.
I think the other thing that Memphis is, like, they could be in a lot worse a situation. Like, Memphis, like, could have lost these games this week and also lost to UTSA, and it'd be like, sky is falling.
Right.
Could have lost to Vanderbilt, same thing, sky is falling. Like, they're one loss away from sky is falling right now.
Yeah, so T-Rank has them 11-7 in the American.
Right.
Like, from an optics perspective, I don't think 11-7 is getting it done in the American.
I would agree, but from an optics perspective, 22-9 Memphis probably is going to be pretty close. But again, theoretically, they should rip through these games. Like, they should win all these games. They're better than all these teams.
Now, SMU at 21, North Texas at 52, and Florida Atlantic is down to 43. Even Charlotte's at 90.
The Yankees varying from the norm much more than normal, I feel like.
They have St. Mary's at, like, 12. I checked that earlier. Which, that feels computer tricker. Right? Like, I think this is more of St. Mary's can just do this to mid-major teams versus how they're going to fare against, you know, if they're a 12 seed or an 11 seed. Like, okay, if they're an 11 seed and they have to play, I don't know, Iowa State in the first round, I think they're getting demolished.
Probably right. I will say this, though. St. Mary's has now lost once since December 2nd. They blew out San Francisco on the road. They blew out Santa Clara on the road in their last two. I think they are the best at-large case that the Mountain West the WCC has right now.
But they have the Weber State and the Missouri State. I remember just before we did a podcast, like a month or so ago, I was looking at their T-Rank page and saying, okay, St. Mary's is actually okay. They can make a run. And then they went out and, like, lost to Missouri State the next day. It's like, well, I don't know about that anymore. But
they can't have any more bad losses. As long as they stay quad one and two the rest of the way, I think they're fine. I wanted to ask you about the Duke loss to Pitt. I don't know if you watched any of that.
No, I was on UConn in the 8 o'clock window, and I was on BYU in the 6 o'clock window.
I watched a lot of that BYU game. Texas Tech, nice rally, Pop Isaacs.
He's so good. I mean, dating back to last year, just every time he shoots, you think it's going in. Warren Washington, I thought, played a great game around the rim. But yeah, it was basically Isaacs going nuclear.
But the Pitt result, how much are we reading into this? Duke loses without Jeremy Roach, without Mark Mitchell, two very important parts of their team. This is not a particularly deep Duke basketball team. This is not a particularly big Duke basketball team. So losing Mark Mitchell was big there. Losing Jeremy, I mean, John Shire told us post-game after the Georgia Tech game, he really thought that Jeremy Roach should be in the All-American conversation in terms of how good he's been, how consistently impactful he's been. You know, the stats maybe not showing quite how good he is in terms of counting stats, but that he really believes he's like an All-American level player. Pitt goes in, pulls off the upset, big time performance from Jalon Lowe, their other freshman point guard. I think it's funny. I mean, if you told me in the preseason, Brad, that both Jalon Lowe and Bub Carrington would be like dudes, and Pitt would still be 2-5 in the ACC, you'd be like pretty confused.
I mean, looking at Pitt's T rank, so prior to the Duke game, their best win was over West Virginia, who was 125.
Yeah.
And their worst loss was to Missouri, who was 119.
Yeah.
So they were 0-4 against the top 124. So they didn't have a top 124 win, and now they get at Duke win. So they still have a long way to go. But yeah, you're right. I mean, figure Hinson was like an all ACC player in the preseason.
Which he is. It's just been.
Their bigs. I mean,
The
Diaz Grand twins, I'm sorry. Like, Guillermo played well in the first four last year when Federico was out. But every time I've seen them this year, they stink. They just jack threes, and I've never seen them hit a three in my life. And Federico is seemingly taking a step back.
Right. They don't really have a rim presence. And I think they've been hurt because I don't think any of their guards are really great creating, like, for themselves. Like, Bub is a passer. Ish Leggett, I don't think, is good enough to be, like, that level of player for you. Right, like, if he's your double-digit wing scorer, I think you're pretty poor.
And then from a Duke perspective, it's hard to just think back to the preseason where I said they were the most talented team in the country. Because with Proctor playing like this, and Mitchell not really taking a huge jump from last year, even, you know, if we were to believe John Shire, and he has two All-Americans, plus another first-round draft pick and Jerry McCain, this team just doesn't feel scary. And I think that's a mix of Mitchell not taking the jump, and then Proctor just not even being that good, let alone being the All-American I thought he would be. Same with Ryan Young, too. He's not. He's seemingly taking a step back, too.
I agree with you, really, the talent level. I think I just don't think you watch them and are all excited, overwhelmed, whatever. I do think it's interesting. Like, the Arkansas and Georgia Tech losses have not aged, and now they have a home loss to Pitt. And again, they beat Pitt on the road by 22, like 2 weeks ago. So it's not as though they're as bad as Pitt, whatever. But I also think when you really watch Duke, and maybe it's just self-selection, but I've seen Duke now twice in person in the last month, and I just watched the Pitt game. Like, they don't look the part of an elite team. I mean, similar to Kansas in that regard, except Kansas has the wins. Like, there's something missing. I don't know what it is. Their schedule has been very forgiving, but it heats up now. They do have Louisville coming up on Tuesday, so you should be fine there. But after that, home Clemson, at Virginia Tech, at North Carolina, you know, they still have later in the year, they have a 3-game road trip at Florida State, at Miami, at Wake. Like, the meat of this ACC schedule is coming, and I think they could fall if they don't really straighten up here.
Another ACC team that's falling is Miami.
Big time.
No, they didn't have Norchad. But like what you were saying with those Duke losses, it's just like too many times that Miami's not showing up and not playing to their talent level.
Four losses in 5 games now.
And like, I still like all these players, and I like Keyshawn George more than I thought I would in the preseason, right?
He could be a sneaky one and done.
And it's still just not... It's not, there's no synergy. There's no, the whole is greater than the sum of the parts.
Miami has a lot of, secondary guys that could be big in the portal. Like, will AJ Casey stick it out?
Well, this whole starting lineup has another year.
Right.
In which case, I would not expect AJ Casey or Christian Watson or Ja'Kai Robinson to be back.
I would.
Or Bensley Joe. I mean, they have Jahlil Bethea.
Right, they have a huge recruiting class coming in with Jahlil Bethea and a couple other guys.
Bethea is supposed to be like an elite shooter, you know, top 10 recruit. I mean, he's not coming off the bench.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see where the rubble leaves this roster, because there's some older guys that could come back. There's some older guys that could turn pro. There's Bethea coming in, but they also have Austin Schwartz, who's a top 50 kid and can really shoot. And then like a developmental 3-4 and Isaiah Johnson, Origu. If I was a coach, I'd be recruiting the hell out of Michael Nwankwo in the portal. I'd be recruiting AJ Casey in the portal. I'd be recruiting Christian Watson. Like, I think there's some pieces here.
Yeah, like George Washington or something is going to strike gold with Christian Watson. He hasn't really popped, but I watched him a lot in high school. I thought he was a good 3-and-D wing with good size.
AJ Casey is a Chicago kid. Can we just like we just pencil him right into DePaul? Whoever's the new coach, you get AJ Casey included.
Man, DePaul, man. Whew. I don't know if you want to move to the Big East, but
we could. Yeah, we could hit some Big East real quick. Yeah,
dude, that Providence DePaul game, that was not a game. It was alarming. You're kind of like DePaul, like what the hell is going on? They can't even catch the ball. Providence got multiple fast breaks because DePaul just like couldn't catch it, and just boom, taken off the other end of the court. Providence won the walk-on minutes. It was Providence walk-ons versus DePaul's bench guys like Kamara and Mac Etienne and those guys. And the walk-ons won. Every single thing. Richard Barron had more family at the game than DePaul had fans. The loudest cheer was when he scored.
Did we talk about the DePaul job last week?
We haven't recently. I think between like St. Louis and DePaul, I think we talked a little bit about.
So here's my thing. People, despite the history, I think when you talk to people around the industry, when I talk to coaches, I talk to agents, there's like a great deal of intrigue about this. And like, it just seems like inevitable that like people will take the job, which I guess I go back and forth every day whether I buy, right? So the idea is that like the floor is like Josh Schertz, right? Like worst case, you know, we just hire this like monster, smart, brilliant guy at Indiana State, and he has to take the job because it's a high major. But like, I think we texted about this, Brad. Is there anyone on this roster worth keeping?
I said yes. I said that Deshaun Nelson, Churchill Abbas, and Jeremiah Odin could all help a good team.
What about Elijah Fisher? Are we out on Elijah Fisher?
I wouldn't say out, but I wouldn't want him starting, I don't think.
Yeah. So I like begrudgingly would take Elijah Fisher. I would probably begrudgingly keep Jaden Henley. Even if I don't love it. I think Jaden Henley is really bad. We hyped him in the preseason. I think that was a mistake. But like there's at most five guys that I would have any interest in keeping. Everybody else like has to go. Like Mac Etienne, whoever ranked Mac Etienne as a top 50 to 100 recruit should not be allowed to do this for a living anymore. Like we need to find
another. You used to explain yourself. Like what happened there?
Like yeah, well, what are we missing? Like he is awful. He is so bad. And like we're talking about
he got like a serious injury at UCLA, so maybe before that he was like an athletic monster or something, but whenever he would be on the court at UCLA, it's like this guy looks small. He's not, like, moving well. And he can't score. Like, what? Like, what is this? I mean, it's the same with Matty Sissoko.
And, yeah, so right, there's what, four or five at most that you'd keep. And one of those guys, Churchill Abass, I think we're mostly just keeping because he's monstrous and, like, has good vibes. Like, Churchill Abass plays really hard out there. He looks like he's having a blast.
He got the start against Butler.
Yeah.
He's a good long-term piece. He's,
yeah, I would keep him. I would also take him in the portal at, like, any mid-plus. But, like, you're inheriting this thing. Sure, you might be able to bring some players with you, right? Like, you know, again, like thinking about some of the regional mid-major coaches who could get the job, right? Like, Josh Schurz could bring, like, Julian Larry and Robbie Avila and whatever. Ideally, but, you know, no guarantees. We've seen guys not follow. Like, Drew Valentine could bring Miles Rubin and Jaden Dawson and, you know, whatever. Brian Wardle could bring a couple of the pieces at Bradley. They've got some good young players. But, like, you're looking around, and it's like, well, we just need a first best player, a second best player, and a third best player, and we'll be all right. And I guess I look at it from this standpoint. Like Cal, like, is – like, DePaul's probably in a similar position to Cal. There's literally nothing worth saving here. Cal got as good of a portal group as you could, right? Between the ties from the old staff, you know, connections, whatever, or from ties from the new staff, excuse me, connections, whatever. They got Keontae Kennedy, Fardaw's AMAC, Jalen Tyson, Jalen Cohn. They're still 7-12.
And, you know, people are going to point to Butler. And they're going to say, well, you know, no one thought Pierre Brooks was going to be this good. No one thought DJ Davis was going to be this good. And just for whatever reason, Posh Alexander as a mediocre starting point guard just fell through the cracks to the team that really needed a mediocre starting point guard. And, like, Andre Screen's been better than people have thought, too. So, yeah, like, if you get seven, like, roll-the-dice transfers and you hit on four of them, you can come in ninth. But, like, Butler's probably not making the tournament. They're probably about to implode. They have Georgetown next. After that, they're probably headed down a dark path here to close the season. And we're going on, what, 20 years of no tournament for DePaul? Like, I think even the most reasonable people could agree. Like, if you can't get it on 20 years, maybe it's best that we find you a lower conference.
Well, I guess my problem is this, like, even if Josh Schurz is, like, bringing Rob, like, if I'm Josh Schurz, like, why am I doing this? I know Indiana State's a terrible job, but, like, would I rather not just, like, take St. Louis? Like, I go back and forth. Like, part of me says DePaul is this great job, right? Here's this opportunity. It's Chicago. Nobody gives a shit what you do. You're going to get time. If you, you know, you just don't have to suck the bars on the floor, et cetera. And then I look at, like, what you're walking into. It's like you're getting nothing. You're literally having to start from scratch, and you're having to sell to kids, like, a 5-win team that, like, you need a best player for.
And also, I mean, we say the bar's on the floor. Like, after year two, I was ready to fire Stubblefield. I mean, it's the same thing when they fire Leitao, right? Oh, bar's on the floor. You'll have a ton of time.
And I actually thought Stubblefield was good until this year. I thought, or not good, but not bad.
The first year, they were feisty, yeah. After last year, I said there's no hope. Yeah, and let's say DePaul pays their coach $2 million, which I think you said it's much less for Stubblefield currently.
Correct.
So any mid-major coach has to take, you know, go from whatever, $300,000 to $2 million. But there's no way out of this. There's no path out.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it'll be interesting. Look, I still think it will be a coveted job, but
you still want Will Wade, or have you moved on to other jobs?
I think Will Wade has the best chance of winning there. But I don't perceive that from what I've heard as having much traction at all. I will say, the Loyola Ramblers are 5-1. 13-6 overall.
Do you really want to do that to your friend Drew? I think as an unbiased person who has never met Drew Valentine, I think if I were making a hiring decision at a high major, I want to see a few more years at Loyola before I throw millions of dollars at him.
I mean, I would have wanted to see more than a couple of years of Kim English.
So did I.
Here we are.
Which I'm on the hot seat of my group chat because back in whatever March, February of last year, I was saying I wanted Kyle Smith. Then after Rothstein had tweeted something about like how Kyle Smith is the man, I put it in the group chat because I fired Kim during the St. John's game.
That's right. Yeah, she fired Kim.
And they're like, my whole group chat turned on me, said I was an idiot, said they're not impressed with Kyle Smith's CBI success.
You need Josh Shirks is what you need.
Might as well keep Kim at this point.
No, I mean, look, I'm not. I can go either way on the Drew thing. I could probably give a presentation as to like things I think would make Drew really good and things that I would have questions about. But I do think the reality of the situation is that if he wins 21 or 22 games at Loyola this year, he's going to be a really strong candidate for shit.
Basically, as long as the coach runs some set plays on offense, I'm fine.
Oh, Loyola runs a lot of sets. You could fire Kim and bring in Drew. CAA on CAA crime.
I just can't get... You can't be like, we're going to run a freewheeling NBA-style offense come in 150.
They use a lot of concepts. College basketball coaches love to tell you that they play out of concepts.
We need some damn set plays. Say what you want about Cooley. He ran some very good set plays.
I will say I saw a really funny tweet. I'm sure you saw this. This had to have been on your For You page. But some guy was claiming that the Cooley hire for Georgetown was a disaster and destined to fail because he's running the flex. And he videotaped like the one flex possession they've run all year.
Yeah.
Or like this is like an abomination to basketball. And it really is. Like watching the flex, you're like, how is this ever an offense? Like how did Gary Williams win national championships by doing this? Like we're all just gonna run around in circles in like a 4 foot radius near the basket.
Well, the elephant in the room is that when Cooley would run the flex, which he ran it less and less every year. I think Jordan Sperber clocked him during the COVID no fans year that we led the country in flex at 11%. That's just like a handful of times a game, really.
Right. Yeah, you play 70 possession game at seven times running the flex.
And then it was even less the last 2 years. But the elephant in the room is when he would run it, we would score. Like he had guys that were like incredible flex players.
No, flex works. It's just one of the most horrific looking offenses ever.
Right. Like I think in a perfect world where you didn't have to consider like players' feelings and desires in recruiting. Like, if we ran the flex every possession, I bet we would be significantly better.
I'm actually curious, I mean, obviously the flex is archaic in some ways. Like it is funny to think about the idea of, like, all right, like, some coach is just going to run flex all the time, and then, like, Josh Shirks is out there with, like, his center at the three-point line and, like, getting face-guarded. And, like, guys getting, like, the easiest layups of all time. And people are like, this is the future. And then, like, Ed Cooley just, like, running down and getting a layup off of, like a physical layup by Alpha Diallo off of a flex.
Yeah, Alpha Diallo was perfect in it. AJ Reeves was sneaky really good in it.
Like, because he's good off the pin downs.
Right, he could shoot that elbow pin down. And then he would get, like, one dunk off a flex cut a game. Like, it was crazy. He had wrinkles that would get like these slice cuts for Nate Watson for and ones. Like it was effective. It just When it doesn't work, it looks absolutely ridiculous.
Yeah.
And then it goes viral on Twitter. And NBA people say, like, this is the death of basketball as we know it.
It's such an ugly game.
But speaking of Georgetown, they look good on Friday. I watched that whole game. Xavier, actually, their schedule is going to ease up. And they're actually in position to actually make the tournament. Probably because that's St. Mary's blowout on a neutral. And they beat Cincinnati at home. But Xavier's projected to go 11-9 or 12-8. I think T-Rank just bumped him down to 11-9.
The quantity of losses is going to be a problem.
But if they go 12-8, that's only 13 losses heading into the Big East tournament.
Right, and Oakland and Delaware just like whatever Q3s.
But like they're not that bad. Like
right, that's what
they're in the 120s, I think, and like Louisville's in the 210, Georgetown's 190.
DePaul's like 309.
Yeah, that's unbelievable.
Let's look, where's DePaul today? DePaul, where are you at? 310.
Yeah, I mean, the Xavier offense, when they're going downhill, like Davion McKnight is just like a torpedo toward the rim. Desmond Claude's playing really well. Oliveri's playing really well. Trey Green's hitting shots. They've now gone Dalen Swain at the four more, and they've benched Djokovic, and that's kind of unlocked another gear for them. But Georgetown looked good. It was an onslaught of jumpers. Masood was getting in on it. Epps obviously had a monster game. Ethan Stiles were hitting shots. Brumbaugh is benched, which is not an outcome I foresaw in the preseason.
Do we think that Brumbaugh is a portal guy?
I'm going to go with no. I think that they'll get one portal guard that'll kind of bridge the gap.
I guess my thing is that Brumbaugh has now been held scoreless in three straight games. And if nothing else, you already still have Kayvon Mulready coming in and Caleb Williams.
But I think if you're getting a starter anyway, like I guess Brumbaugh could stick around. But I kind of buried the lead there with Georgetown. I think the biggest difference might be that Supreme Cook has really found his game. He's like an absolute monster inside.
I'm a Supreme Cook fan. They need Bryce Hopkins in the portal. They need Bryce Hopkins to play the four. They need to ditch like the Jay Heath minutes. They need like a real guard.
Well, Heath is done anyway, but it's
yes.
Yeah, so next year if they go like a portal point guard with Epps, Stiles, Hopkins, and Cook, then your bench can have Sorber, Fielder, Mulready, McKenna, and Brumbaugh. Like the expectations will be back on for Cooley.
How about this? Jay Heath has just had like a beyond miserable college basketball career.
Yeah.
5-year career. First 2 years at Boston College. At BC, first year he goes 13-19. They lose their final six games. Second year he's at Boston College. They go 4-16, 2-11 in the league. Then he transfers to Arizona State. Arizona State goes 14-17. Which is the worst year they've had under Bobby Hurley. Then he goes to Georgetown. Year one at Georgetown, they go 2-18 in the league, 7-24 overall. And this year at Georgetown, they're 8-7, 1-6 in the league. He hasn't even like come close to winning.
And I think every year he's probably averaged double figures.
Yeah, he's probably like a 1,200 point scorer. I would guess. Let's look. Anyway, but what else do we have to get to on this pod? I feel like we've covered a lot, but my brain is a bit mush because of the events of the last 72 hours or so.
Some great Big East games. We'll see if Providence's season is back on. Wednesday they have at Seton Hall. Seton Hall's still in good shape. St. John's is going to take a little slip here, but they'll be favored in their last six games. That'll straighten it out. Villanova is a team that's got to start winning as well, and their schedule doesn't necessarily ease up. They've already played both their DePaul games. And they blew a close one against UConn that I thought that they could have won. Two late hooking fouls by Justin Moore. Lance Ware is just an absolute abomination. It's like kind of insane how little of an impact he's had for them.
Do we think he hits the portal again?
He has to, because Eric Dixon has another year.
That he probably should use.
Yeah, like where's he going? And Villanova supposedly has these deep pockets. So Ware should hit the portal, and he should go to, like, maybe not Siena, but maybe like Fordham or something.
Yeah, he should be in the Atlantic 10.
He's got to play. Like, I'm sure it's nice he got his $300,000, and it's probably worth it, you know, to play eight minutes a game this year for $300,000. But his last year, he needs to, like, build up a body of work to get a pro contract, right? But
yeah, all those teams in the Big East are, like, they played competitive enough non-conferences. Like, St. John's lost the Michigan game and the Dayton game and the BC game. You know, you mentioned Villanova. Villanova lost the big all their Big Five games. Even, like, Seton Hall had the four, I think, non-conference losses. So All these teams have a slightly thinner margin because they're all going to wind up in, like, that 19-12, 18-13, 17-14 range. So they got to keep winning, and if nothing else, these bottom the 8 and 9 in the league, Providence and Butler, are not as easy to navigate as you would have expected.
And I think Butler's definitely done, but there is a pretty straightforward path of them getting back into the tournament. Just be winning a couple road games. I don't think that they will, but it's not out of the realm of possibility. And for Providence, they just need to steal like one or two road games to get back into it. But yeah, if you're rooting for a 7-bid Big East, you need Providence, Butler, and obviously Georgetown and DePaul to lay down, and then UConn to some extent give up some wins as well.
I will say the one thing that I really liked. I want to see if I can find it. T-Rank tweeted out a thing about the like it was like a chart of like what percentage chance for number of bids for each league. I want to see if I can find that for the Big East. I think I'd be interested in that. The Big East right now, just overall their tourney cast odds, it's basically a lock for UConn, Creighton, and Marquette. Then Villanova St. John's 82%, Villanova 74%, 48% for Xavier, only 42% for Seton Hall, which was very low. Providence 38.5%, and then Butler 14. So there is at least seemingly a path, but they're going to need some breaks. Trying to think of other stuff we really wanted to get to on this episode. I feel like we've covered a lot of ground.
Oh, a huge Pac-12 week for their bids. The Mountain Schools are at the Washington Schools.
The Mountain Schools had a good week protecting home court. Utah and Colorado beating Oregon, setting Oregon back a little bit.
And now I believe Oregon has the Arizona schools.
That
I believe
is
at home.
Correct. Yes.
So that's as we continue to have the Pac-12 take shape. How about this? I mean, I watched a very good portion of UCLA Arizona. I think you got to be concerned about Arizona at this point.
So the weird thing is that their metrics haven't really slowed at all.
Win big, lose close, right? That's
right. Yeah, I mean, they beat Colorado by 47, then turned around a week later and lost to Washington State by 3.
Right.
But So what is your, like, diagnosis? Like, what is your concern?
I honestly don't know, because I still look at this team as elite. I still look at this front court as being super intimidating. And I like the guards. We can't blame everything on Caleb Love.
Yeah.
I mean, even down to, like, KJ Lewis looks good. You know, like, their eighth man looks good. Like, everything looks good. It's just not coming out.
Their KenPom missile page is still a whole lot of green, even in conference play. You know, I don't know what the common thread is. Like, you could say it's three-point shooting. Like, the four losses, they were 6 for 16, 7 for 25, 7 for 26, and 7 for 24 from three. Is that what it is? Probably.
At this level, you have to make shots.
At most levels, you gotta make some shots. But, yeah, like, I think individually, none of the results that they've had are that surprising, shocking. I mean, USC shot the ball – or UCLA, excuse me, shot the ball extremely well early in the game. Built that lead. Then the second half just, you know, didn't have enough in the tank. I have a hard time questioning it with Arizona, but I also think, like, basically every 2 weeks they're losing a game they shouldn't lose. I guess here would maybe be my only retort to this Arizona discourse. Maybe Arizona just isn't that good. Like, they're very good, but their resume is, we beat Duke at Duke. Okay, well, Pitt just did that. Well, we beat Michigan State on a neutral. Well, Michigan State 11-7, right? Well, we beat Wisconsin at home. Well, Wisconsin's fine, but Wisconsin just lost to Penn State. Like, Wisconsin is not a title team, right? They didn't beat, you know, and we beat Alabama. Well, Alabama is everyone's great win. Alabama. It's the win for Creighton. It's the win for Tennessee. It's the win for
Ohio State.
It's the win for Clemson. Without the Alabama win, Clemson is in the toilet here. So, I don't know. I guess my thought on Arizona is, like, maybe they had a little bit of the Memphis quality where, like, they beat teams right before we realized that, like, we needed to get off the island.
And I mean, the loss to Florida Atlantic looks worse.
Although FAU is still holding on. Found a way in overtime today against a terrible UTSA. 34-7-3 from Jonnell Davis. The big issue for FAU seems to be defense.
Yeah, because they're so small. Because they play, what, Elijah Martin at the four?
It's really like... Witherspoon at the four, a lot of it, but
he's six four, yeah.
But it wasn't a problem last year, even in their big games. Like, they were good, and they were top 50 defensively in the non-con, and that included Illinois, that included Arizona, that included St. Bonaventure, that included Butler and A&M. Like, I actually thought when I asked multiple coaching staffs that played FAU about playing against them. And they said in the non-conference, the thing that stood out to them was defense. They're so connected on that end of the floor. They're switchable 1 through 4 because they're all small, and they just get up into you, right? Like, they're physical at the point of attack. They're under, you know, they're underneath you. They're getting steals. They're just, you know, they're just stopping you from running your stuff. And they had Golden protecting the rim, so, you know, that was a huge deal. And last year they were a top 15 2-point defense. Well, this year they're down to 127. If you just look in conference play, I mean, teams are shooting 54% at the rim against them. I mean, they are getting crushed at the rim, and I don't know if it's an effort thing with these guys defensively, because, like, we know that Brian Greenlee can defend, we know that Jalen Gaffney can defend, we know that Martin can defend, and Jonnell can defend. They just haven't gotten stops.
And I don't think we've seen FAU play the top of the American yet, right? Definitely not Memphis.
They haven't played Memphis. They haven't played SMU. They haven't played North Texas. They haven't played, that's the four. That's the four. South Florida, I guess, would be in that mix sort of now.
And then Charlotte, they lost.
Yeah.
I don't think Charlotte's at the top of the American. They're just kind of fraudulently hanging in there right now. But
hey, they're a 90 in T rank.
Good for them. So it'll be interesting. I think FAU's gonna be okay. But
another team that I think we have to issue a mea culpa for, because I thought they were gonna be abhorrent. That's Richmond. Doing with former Siena transfer Jordan King, right?
He has been unbelievable. So the things you couldn't have really predicted were that Jordan King would be, like, the best guard in the Atlantic 10. I thought he had a chance to be decent, but, like, he was just, like, a volume shooter at ETSU. Like, I thought he'd be – efficiency-wise, he would struggle. He's been, like, a monster, like a 50-40-80 guy, hyper-efficient, makes you pay every time. And then they have Neil Quinn in the post, who's a solid player. And they have these, like, bigger wings with G. Bailey and Isaiah Bigelow. The thing that's really surprising is they're a really good defense. I mean, they are top 40 in KenPom defense, which would be the best defense that they've had under Chris Mooney dating back to 2010 when they got a 7 seed. Their best, you know, so one of their best teams. I don't quite understand where that's coming from. They're starting 2 sub-6-foot guards. They're starting a white guy, big man who can't jump at all in Neil Quinn. Like, he's not like a big rim protector. He's big, you know, but he's not like a huge rim protector. Like, they've just found ways to really defend. They take care of the ball. They get, you know, they get good shots because of King and Quinn. And here they are. They've won 8 straight. They're probably not really an at-large team because they lost most of their big ones in the non-conference. But, I mean, kudos to them. You know, the A-10 right now is Dayton and then everybody else. But Richmond is 5-0 with them. And then the next team is Loyola, who I mentioned before, 5-1 with 3 road wins after winning at Fordham on Saturday.
And I still think Dayton is a bubble-caliber team. I acknowledge they're going to get like a 4 seed this year.
I think they're better than bubble, but I would agree they're closer to like 9 seed than 4 seed.
But I think that they're going to run through the A-10, have 1 or 2 losses, and collect their 4 seed. And we'll see how they do against McNeese State or James Madison or whoever they get in that 4-13 game.
Yeah, A-10's hot seat heating up a little bit clearer. Duquesne 0-5 now. I think this is the last year of Keith Dambrock's contract. I think that will potentially open, which sucks. I think actually he's a very good coach. But he's getting older. They just haven't broken through. Curious where they would go.
Jared Calhoun.
Jared Calhoun would be a very good hire. Might be too similar to Dambrock. You could look at, like, I know Drew Joyce will get a look. He's Keith's top assistant. That's like a LeBron tie. I don't know that he would be the hire. Brandon Knight from Rutgers could be a hire there. The only thing is, would he leave before the class gets there? Kenya Hunter at Indiana is an alum. That could be played out. So that'll be interesting. St. Louis is certainly on a hot seat. And then St. Joe's will be interesting to see where they land. I think they should get fired if they aren't like top third of the league, but they may wind up being okay enough that they don't.
And then right when Archie built up all this goodwill, they got blasted twice. He's not in the hot seat though. They owe him too much money.
He's got like another year or two. I also think he's actually pretty good. So, and they played those are 2 of the toughest road games in the league at Bonnie's at Dayton. So you just don't want to lose by 35. But anything else? I feel like we've covered it.
Yeah, can't think of anything else.
All right, folks, we will wrap it up. See you all next week with more updates. This is a loaded show. Again, as I said at the top, appreciate everyone's support, kind words. Hopefully, hoping for good news on the SI front, but we will certainly keep you all posted. And if nothing else, we will see you all next week because college basketball is slowing down. So it should be fun.